under the grazing prohibition emergency with emergency declarations. And that we spent a great deal of time and a lot of questions on that. Particularly the Republican side of the aisle was very skeptical of that position, because the way the bill is written, it has the prohibition on every appropriation where there's acquisition for WNAs or Native Prairie. So that is 14 different appropriations. So it was presented as if the 14 different appropriations saying grazing is prohibited is some type of nefarious thing against grazing. I guess just what I
think. No, I think that's accurate.
And the reason that it's 14 is that it's applied to every appropriation, because these are riders on session law rather than changing statute. So the questions came up, well, are you going back on money that on property that has been previously purchased? And the answer is no, because you would put these on each of the appropriations. And it would be dealing with only these appropriations going on rather than changing the statute. And because we're on an annual cycle, somebody wants to change that, they can change it. But these are the recommendations of the council. So I think there will be extensive questioning about that, and probably an amendment to remove those prohibitions. I think that probably is very likely. The second area was the Dakota County Vermilion project. Questions, most of the questions we've heard here about the trail and the mining. And Dakota County was there, answered questions. That was kind of a bipartisan, I would say, questioning about the precedent of purchasing land with aggregate mining continuing. There were minor questions just on how the wild rice appropriation would occur. And then there was significant questioning about the Fond du Lac appropriation. But I would say, if I think about the time that was spent, probably more was spent on grazing than anything else, maybe than anything else combined. And it was being framed as an anti-agriculture, that the council's recommendations were anti-agriculture.
So we're going to have staff put together a description, because I think there was some confusion about it as well, what our rationale was in terms of doing this so that we didn't have grazing take place on wildlife habitat with ones specifically identified as wildlife habitat. There was just confusion over the whole issue. So, and the Fond du Lac will put a package together that explains that, gives everybody the information they've seen. The only other thing that came up was tilt. And there was a question whether or not tilt could be applied for purchases that are taking place using these funds for these going forward. Obviously, you can't go back, but that was just a question that was raised. If, as we're buying land that's subject to TILT, if we should be responsible for that going forward, which was acknowledged to be a legal issue, and certainly not on the council can answer.
Jim? Yeah, David, I'm just curious. Our restriction on the grazing, that was under emergency, wasn't it? But they could still use grazing as a management tool.
Yeah, and we did explain that. It was really, I would say it was about just being anti-agriculture is the tone that it took. And I think a little bit of misunderstanding about where it would apply and how often. So we have a little education to do. But I think Rick's right, it's going to come back. It's not going to go away.
And so when we are in session, then any member of the committee can make a motion and there could be amendments.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I'm not sure what's going on with the Senate.
The Senate has not opened the doors yet, so we have no bill. We've got a promised author. We'll let you know when the fun begins. Just one takeaway from listening to Rick and being there yesterday. The issue of amendments probably confined, although not guaranteed, to policy. And that's something that the council needs to grapple with, is that sort of thing. I wanted to bring your attention to a letter that I have passed copies out from the Shell Rock River Watershed District. Comes to pass that I believe it was in 2012 or 2013 we appropriated a little over $1 million for a project on the Albert Lee Lake. That was a carp barrier and an AMA acquisition. It's a nice project. And the Watershed District engineered the project and put out the bids twice. And first time they were $1 million plus over in terms of the bids. And second time the bids came in $650,000 to $700,000 over what's available. The project is funded about 75% with Outdoor Heritage funds and 25% with funds from the district. So they have money in the project. And they have a problem. They don't have enough money. And they've got a commitment. So they've written us a letter that's putting us on notice that this is the case. We've talked with the district, and there are a couple of things that have come up. One is they expressed the intent to introduce a general fund financed bill to bring in the remainder of the funds. So they're seeking the money to round out the project from the general fund. We talked with them extensively day before yesterday and suggested that it might be appropriate for them to talk with the Department of Natural Resources people managing the $7.5 million carp barrier appropriation that's not fully committed, as we understand it. Now, there are things that could happen that could make that statement not be accurate, but as we sit here right now, there's a good chance that the department will be looking for places to construct carp barriers and with them. So we've asked them to talk with the department about that as an alternative way to solve the problem. We took the time to make sure they understand that where we are in the process, there's no council approach to bring the money into the bill. We've allocated all the money we have available. There are other things going on that affect that as well, and I don't have full information, so I'll leave those for a later date. But depending on what the legislature does in terms of the sales tax reform, and that kind of effort, the numbers may change. I think we have enough in our $5 million cushion to handle all these changes, and have talked to the fiscal people in the House. I haven't talked to the Senate. And they believe that we do, too. I don't see any change in it, but I'm trying to get the point across that we've budgeted pretty much what's available and don't have a lot of alternatives. So we'll keep you informed how this is going forward. We'll put the bill, when it's introduced, on the tracker so you can see it on a regular basis and understand where their bill is going, if anywhere. I'll say one last thing. This is one of the fundamental problems of funding projects. And it's a problem that you don't have when you fund programs to the extent that in a program you're feeding money in every fiscal year. And they can look and see what their needs are and bring to the council in the presentation of their request problems like this. And we've seen this in some of the acquisition programs, and we've run into appraisals that are higher than we expected, and we've allowed and authorized split funding over fiscal years. So you all will see a fiscal year appropriation in the list. And in carrying that out, what may in fact happen is the last item funded in the fiscal year will be split between the fiscal year one and fiscal year two. You can't do that with a project, and this is where we're sitting. So, if there are any questions about that, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Just a theoretical question. I think the next calculation of sales tax is at the end of March, is that right?
February 28th is the calculation of the fund statements are 3 weeks after.
Would that be viewed as outside of our purview to, if there were extra funds at that point, to somehow act on it in this round's money, theoretically?
I think there's two questions in there. One is that the February 28th thing will tell what budget we have,
right.
Really what the... I mean, every month we get a statement of what the receipts are,
right.
What the receipts are coming in based on the projections. But the projection that counts is the one that's released on the 28th. So we'll know, you know, within 2 weeks here, what is really available for appropriation. Kind of gets into the same question as last year. We have to make appropriations or recommendations by January 15th.
Right, right.
But I think we also had, this year, made some, with our motions, talking about looking at things in the future. So I think there's a little bit of foreshadowing that was done during the session. The bigger challenge comes in if we repeal a number of the business-to-business taxes and some of the sales taxes, then that money isn't there, and then they'll have to recalculate the forecast. And that,
so just assuming the money is there, let's just answer the second part of the question with the understanding that the money there's no problem of any kind.
I think it's within our purview to say things have changed and we want you to listen. They can listen or not. But
right.
We certainly can suggest changes.
And the shortfall is now $650 to $700, and that's based on the second round of bids that is still $650 over the estimate.
Just to follow up on the policy side, I think when you have something like this where something didn't make the bid and the legislature has voted on it, we've had a shortfall, they have a history of making recommendations, of following through, I think that's looked on more favorably than if there was, here's a new project.
Right.
So I think the legislature would have, and we're not talking a huge amount of money. So I think there would be more support for this type of addition on there, and that could be adapted into the bill. You know, if there's, it would be easier for me as an author, and also I'm sure for the Senate, if the council has made a recommendation, put the money in, if we have the money, and we just do it that way. But that would make it easier because it's the council's recommendation. the challenge is there really money there?
But,
but again, we're not dealing with the reserve that we've...
It always is.
The reserve we've recommended is about $5 million compared to some of the other funds.
Right.
So, again, something like this, I think, would be worthwhile to do. And the next meeting is... We'll have a pretty good handle on it. Thanks.
Okay. Other questions? Ron?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the bottom line is, are we going to stop the carp there? And did the watershed people tell you they would approach DNR and talk to them about their carp fund? I mean, that money's sitting there, and certainly would be, I would think, appropriate.
Mr. Chair, we agreed to do it. The meeting is today.
The problem might be some.
Right.
We need to work our way through. But I'm glad to hear that I hear a consensus that the council ought to push to make sure this is done and do whatever we can do to do that.
Farm bill side, it turns out there's no wetland reserve program in the farm bill. There are other programs that conserve wetlands, both in the NRCS and in the FSA, all under the Department of Agriculture. This is important to us because we have three appropriations, two that are passed and one that's in the current bill. Now, taking it at face value, without a contorted interpretation, direct the Board of Water and Soil Resources to work with the NRCS and Department of Agriculture to fund wetland restorations with a combination of Outdoor Heritage Fund and Wetland Reserve Program funds. So we've lost the match that we anticipated when we wrote the appropriations. There is, however, as we understand it, a considerable amount of opportunity for match elsewhere in USDA. So I'm reporting that what we have done is talked with council and devised an amendment that will go into our bill, hopefully as an author's amendment with a friendly author, to rectify this situation. And basically what we're doing is saying to the Board of Water and Soil Resources, work with USDA, find the best match you can find, matching program that does wetland restoration. So that's something you'll see that's different. We are also changing the title of the appropriation in the current bill, which refers to the wetland, the WRP program, and are changing the title so that's not referred to any longer. So that's the bulk of my report. I've got one final thing. It's a personal announcement, and I wanted to let the council know that I've expressed to LCC and to the director that my last day with the council will be the first pay period in January of 2015. And I've done this early, so you all have plenty of time to find the right person to do the job in the future. Now, I want to say it's been an incredible honor to be the first executive director and let you know it's allowed me to fulfill a lifelong ambition that came from growing up in Missouri with one of the two lawyers who created the Missouri Conservation Commission amendment and initiative and referendum in 1934, I think.
We have to be slower here.
And someday we'll talk
talk all about it and what fun it's been. But it's been a real honor, and my objective has been at every turn to make the decision that makes the council as strong as it can possibly be. And the decisions may not always look that way, but God guarantee you, that's what I've been trying to do. So thank you for the opportunity. We'll have a good 7 months, 8 months, whatever's left. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Bill, and we will be sorry to see you go, but know that it's the right time for you, and have great appreciation for what you've set in motion, because this council is indebted to the way you have set this up to work, because it's worked really well.
Thank you.
Thanks, David. I just have a quick question, Bill. On the exchange for WRP, do we know that we'll get as favorable a match with other programs that might be substituted?
Mr. Chair, Council Member Box, I've asked the question, and the answer has been we can't predict. We've thought about writing an amendment that required a 1.6 match, but if we do that, it doesn't come. We've got the money hung up. I think what the council has to do is, and this is a good example of where the accomplishment plan discussions become important, is use the accomplishment plan to make certain that the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Department of Agriculture, U.S. Department of Agriculture, do the best they can and get the best deal for Minnesota. And it'll require some detailed inspection. You'll have to take time to go into some depth in finding out what the options were, and we'll help you do that.
So, Rick?
It may be good for that March 14th meeting to have USDA, NRCS, and Bowser come in. They should be able to have a little more detail on things. And it affects more than just this appropriation. It's kind of overall on what the Farm Bill package is going to be for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I was in Washington Thursday and Friday talking to various folks about things such as Farm Bill. And we now have a Farm Bill, but they haven't written the rules for how it's going to be administered. And it's all about rules. It's not about what's in the bill. It's how it's interpreted by the staffs that write the rules. And it's going to be, they're estimating 6 to 9 months of that until the rules get written. So we can and should bring somebody in here to say this is what it looks like, but the truth of how it works and how it will affect this isn't going to be known for some time yet. Unfortunately.
Not until after our next round.
We could get lucky or we could not get lucky.
We probably won't.
So let me just talk a little bit about the process. Bill's obviously shared with me that he's planning to retire. Let me talk a little about the process. We're somewhat limited because of the open meeting law and have to be very careful about how we do this. Greg Huber, excuse me, I can't even pronounce your name, Greg, today, but he and I have talked and as well as conferring with Jeff Dyson on how to stay at a point where the council can have input in the process but not be in violation of the open meeting law. Greg is going to ask certain members to serve on an informal task force to help him get to the point of bringing some finalist candidates to the whole council. The things that we have talked about in terms of criteria for who gets selected would be it cannot consist of a quorum of any other committee that we have, because that would be viewed as a quorum. Even though this is an advisory group to LCC, we can't be putting a quorum in place. I think we need to have appointees that come from the Senate, House, and government and governor's side, so that all branches are represented. From a citizen standpoint, I think it's important that those that are on this advisory group are those that have 2 years left in their appointment, so that whoever is selected is working with those people. Not that people won't be reappointed, but we obviously don't know what's going to happen at the end of the year. From the legislator side, we need both Republican and a Democrat, and we need both House and Senate, so that it's very broad. And Greg and I will reach out to various members and ask you if you're willing to serve based on that criteria. LCC will manage the process, put the job description together. We'll have a chance to look at that. They'll do the advertising. They'll develop a candidate pool, and then narrow that pool down for us until we get to a decision. My goal, and Bill conferred, Bill agrees, is that we have someone in place by September 1st so that there's an overlap. Bill's vacation time allows him to essentially stop working the middle of November, just before Thanksgiving. So the goal is to have someone mirroring Bill during our next round, so that they're fully versed in that and they're not coming in and trying to learn based on what they've heard versus what they've experienced. So we have lots of time to get this done, which should, we can thank Bill for giving us lots of advance notice, and we can have as seamless a transition as possible. So, any questions about that? Rick?
I just have a finance question on how it works, because the appropriations were changed for the administrative costs to be ongoing rather than be on the annual appropriation. So we would have, I guess my question is, we have enough with the hiring we've done and with the payout, I'm assuming you have some sick leave, and so there would be, we would have the funds to cover that.
What I will tell you is Bill's been thinking about this for a while, and there's enough in our budget to cover that.
One of my objectives is to make sure the next executive director doesn't have a fiscal problem when they walk in the door.
Thanks for asking for my question. No. Bill obviously has set this in motion, having given it a fair amount of consideration. For which we thank. We're running a little behind schedule here, but next on our agenda is an information piece on the outdoor recreation system. That would be helpful. Bob, sorry to make you wait.
May I have a few words?
You may have a few words.
I'm going to pass out a letter that you all have received earlier from Cassie County. And this is the letter that basically brought this presentation to you. And what it is a letter that discusses an ATV trail that was, and will be liable to cross over county forest land that we put out for heritage fund money. And we sent the letter out and began talking with members about it individually, and it was clear that this was sort of a surprise that this might happen. And as I thought about it, I realized that in Minnesota there's a framework for management of natural resources, and it's in statute. And there are parallel units at the federal and county level. And that it would be very much worthwhile time of the council to thoroughly understand that. Because when we write an appropriation for a state unit, like a WMA, when we say it's going to be a WMA, there's a whole package of intent that flows in with that nomination or naming that it's a WMA. And
I believe that legislators, when they read our bill and vote for it or against it, are taking into consideration what units we're funding and believe that there's a certain intent. And all of this bears on section or subdivision 15. At any rate, our deed restriction, conveyance, power, or authority, or responsibility, however you want to look at it, that if push came to shove in discussing what was intended, that the unit would be an important part of it. So with that as background, Bob, thank you very much for taking the time to come explain 86A and related units and issues.
Mr. Chairman, members of the record, Bob Lyon, Department of Natural Resources, and I may ask counsel to step in and provide clarification as well. I don't think Mr. Knapp maybe wrote parts of the Outdoor Recreation Act, but I'm not quite sure. And Mr. Chairman, as you previously mentioned, rules drive a lot of different things, and also with the Outdoor Recreation Act, each unit has a set of rules and sometimes corresponding statutes related to the use and prohibitions on these units. It's my intention to give a brief overview and then bring up actual project managers for each of the, well, the major units of the Outdoor Recreation Act that the council interacts with, and they can provide a brief overview. And I don't know if you want to wait for questions until the end or have questions of each individual project manager.
If questions come up, we'll ask them at the time. So that
that'd be great. Thank you very much. As I mentioned, the Outdoor Recreation Act was created in 1975 in Minnesota Statutes 86A, and it classifies land management units and outlines purposes, scope, recreation, and administration. It also provides guidance on establishment, development, rules, authorization, and acquisition of these units. The land units that are listed in the Outdoor Recreation Act in 86A.05 include scientific and natural areas, SNAs, state wilderness areas, state forests, state wildlife management areas, wild, scenic, and recreational rivers, aquatic management areas, state parks, state recreation areas, state trails, state water access sites, state historic sites, which are most, for the most part, managed by the Minnesota Historical Society, state rest areas, state boulder waysides. The newest unit, I believe, is the aquatic management area that we added probably 7 or 8 years ago. And also, the state boulder wayside is one of the newest units in there. Otherwise, most of them, I think the remaining of them, have been in there since 1975. The other thing to keep in consideration as we talk about these things is that there's other layers of management or laws that guide these units as well. There's federal law, especially federal law applies when we use federal funding to mix into these acquisitions, such as land and water conservation funding, or if we were to use some Dingle Johnson or Wall Perot dollars, federal excise tax dollars on acquisitions. There's a whole layer of federal law that comes in with that. Many units, if there's going to be any development, such as a trail or a park, in some wildlife management areas where we have permanent residences, which we don't, there's the bigger ones up that way they require a development plan. But we have a master planning process that's outlined in Chapter 86A that there's a public participation process that creates the goals and the directions for those activities and development of those units. Each unit has, for the most part, rules and rulemaking authority. Sometimes there's commissioner's operational orders. In the case of parks, we have rules and operational orders that dictate camping, sometimes it's the price of firewood, the price of rental things, stuff like that. And then also local ordinances come into play as you look at discharging the firearms and things like that within the metropolitan area or other charter cities. So with that, we're going to start off with our staff presentations, and we'll bring up Bob from Wildlife Management, from Fish and Wildlife Division, to discuss wildlife management.
Good morning, Council, Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Bob Welsh, Section of Wildlife. I guess I have the task of going first to spend just a couple minutes talking about these units. wildlife management areas are the flagship of the section of wildlife and provide a lot of wildlife habitat and recreational opportunity. And that first bullet is right out of 86A subdivision 8 and 86A05. And they are established to protect lands and waters which have a high potential for wildlife production, and develop and manage these lands and waters for production of wildlife for public hunting, fishing, and trapping, and other compatible outdoor recreational use. Further down in 86A, as it defines some of that in a little bit more detail, but then it ends with that development may provide access, but minimize the intrusion on the natural environment. So, therefore, if you go into a WMA, for example, and look at a water access, it's going to be pretty rustic compared to a water access at a large boating lake, for example. We have about 1,440 units statewide, totaling just under 1.3 million acres. The bullets on this slide are just some of the kind of the guiding principles that guide our management staff and the uses of the unit. There's besides 86A, there are a few items in statutory authority, such as use protection. There's a fairly recent statute that protects the uses of WMAs from changes in local ordinances, such as discharge ordinances or noise ordinances or leash ordinances, for example. Portable stands for use with bear hunting was specifically addressed in statute quite recently, and cooperative farming agreement authority is given in statute. Then we step down to administrative rule that is in 6230. And then there's a number of subparts under that, but these generally guide the general and special provisions where they're needed. And then, as Bob alluded to, we have formal plans on major units. We have 8 major units in the state, and they all have formal plans, have gone through the formal planning process. And then some other individual WMAs may have gone through formal plans if need dictates. And then the remainder of the WMAs kind of fall under management guidance documents. These are internal documents and have not gone through an extensive formal review from the public and other divisions. But these are the general guidance to if a future manager comes in, things that they might need to know as far as the general management of vegetation on the unit, some of the management of the facilities, perhaps some of the discussions and arrangements managers have cultivated with neighbors, those types of things. And then finally, you get down to operational orders, which dictate some of the tools that managers use that are cross divisional. For example, invasive species op order. There's an op order on pesticide use. There's an up order on prescribed burning, those types of things, just to make sure that they are handled consistently across all the divisions. And then finally, delegated authority in places in statute. For example, the cooperative farming, the statute references the fact that the commissioner has authority to enter into cooperative farming agreements, and then through delegation orders, that's delegated down to the regional manager to actually sign those agreements. And this side,
what's the expectation in the rules or the direction you have regarding trails?
Well, trails is one that we've struggled with over the years. We generally consider a formal trail something that, you know, comes through a unit as incompatible, but at the same time we have managed trails such as hunter walking trails that are developed specifically for hunter use, and then there are trails that we have in place for management purposes and then become de facto trails, if you will. But the maybe Bob can touch on it a little more from a policy standpoint, but we also recognize that that we're having to wrestle with this because of land prices and interests in places that we can't do it by ourselves, and so we've had to kind of struggle with this trail issue.
Mr. Chairman, members, that is a great point. As a lot of the discussion we've had in this committee this year, focusing on the Vermilion Highlands Edition, the Sempstone property that we're looking to acquire and working with Dakota County on their trail corridor. But we're also seeing issues in areas of the state that are high priorities for us, in the Prairie, for example, where counties and citizens and user groups are very concerned about acquiring wildlife management areas without providing some sort of opportunity for recreation as well. Actually, one of the things we're talking about that's going to have to come to the council at some point in the future is a lot of the green corridor projects that have been purchased in the Renville County area. They want to create a system of trails, and this is one of the things we're struggling with, is how do you do it on these units? But what we're talking about is a conservation recreation area concept, or trying to think about, do we create a new unit in the Outdoor Recreation Act that allows for conservation, but also some kind of compatible uses that will provide that recreation at certain times of the year. Horseback riding is a main use that a lot of people want to do down there, and I think the vision is to provide a connection between Upper Sioux State Park to Fort Ridgely, kind of down that corridor, talking about the historic and also the conservation values, and connect that area where a person would be able to do a number of day rides or a series of overnight stays, perhaps in bed and breakfast or something with stables. But that's the vision that people have. And in other parts of the state, it's becoming more complicated for us to spend the conservation dollars because some people view wildlife management areas as being too prescriptive. So it's something we need to struggle with. We need to work with you all on it and do it with our eyes wide open. But the master planning drives those decisions, right? So just as we have an accomplishment plan here that we present to you all, a master plan would dictate where those corridors would be, how it would work, and the opportunities that it would provide. What I struggle with personally is how do you provide with recreational access during the nesting season, so to speak, right? So there's going to be probably very limited opportunities, depending on where a trail corridor would be identified in some of these units. But it's working with, just as we do conservation grazing to help deal with the acceptance within the agricultural community, I think we need to try to figure out as a group, especially moving into the future, how do we deal with this issue of multiple use, compatible uses, so to speak, to help us gain acceptance in areas of the state that are high priority. So, something to think about as we move forward.
I might add that something that contributes to that complexity is that, unlike some of the other units that have statutory boundaries, WMAs don't have statutory boundaries. They're simply designated by the commissioner, and so therefore they need to go through county board approval for purchase. And so then we need to make these acquisitions palatable to the county as well. And in some cases, when we have there's always the opportunity that a transportation easement or a trail easement or something like that could be acquired beforehand, and then we purchase the land with the encumbrance on it. So we'd like to be involved in those conversations beforehand, so that we could perhaps have some say in where those easements might be, whether we often will push for them to be on the edge or associated with a transportation corridor, a highway, for example. But people who use trails, they want to go into scenic areas and not alongside the highway. So we have that.
Jim? Bob, I'm just a question. I mean, what compatible uses, if we take WMAs,
which most people think of used for hunting. But let's take those. I mean, can hunters camp on them? Can they use motorized vehicles on them? Can they train dogs on them? Can they do anything on them other than just traditional hunting?
Those are really good questions, Jim, and a lot of that is outlined. Excuse me. Those are really good questions, Councilmember Cox, members of the council, and a lot of that is outlined in 6230. And I was given 2 to 3 minutes, so I wasn't going to step down too far. But in 6230, vehicular use is outlined. You know, on some units where there are interior roads, vehicles can be used, and those are defined to the major units and where posted. Camping can occur on some units where they're posted. So on some of the major units, such as Mille Lacs WMA, for example, has camping areas due to its remoteness, its size, so therefore the number of people that would be using it, say, during the opening weekend deer hunting, and there aren't a lot of opportunities nearby for housing, for accommodations. So some of those opportunities are available. Generally speaking, the things that are defined as compatible uses are basically foot activities. So wildlife watching, hiking, snowshoeing, cross country skiing, you know, those types of things. Cross country skiing, other than a form of groomed trail. Dog training, you know, an individual can train their dog. Except for during the nesting season, the dogs are required to be on a leash during the next nesting season. And then if a person is out exercising / training their dog outside of the nesting season, they can do that as long as they're not discharging a firearm or discharging to launch training dummies and those types of things. Did I hit them all?
Those are basically the exception. I mean, the rule is that you can camp on the majority of them. You cannot use motorized vehicles on the majority of them. You can't dog train other than in the fall. I mean, there's really not a lot of compatible uses other than, for the most part.
That is correct.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, suppose we go back to a couple of slides. And I'm still trying to understand the bullet point on development to provide access but minimize intrusion. The word intrusion, can you put a little more interpretation on that?
I can try. The access is basically reasonable access to the area, so a safe place to park off of the highway, and those are usually done, you know, in very rustic surface. There's almost never a paved surface. I'm not familiar with a paved surface parking area out there, other than perhaps some gravel, or else if the soil is conducive to it, it'll just be mowed. Perhaps a wire fence or some posts in the ground around the perimeter of the parking area. And then some signage to let folks know that it's a wildlife management area. Water access may be simply a spot identified where you can slide a duck boat off of your truck or out of your pickup and slide it down into the water. Since motorized use is prohibited, that includes motor boats, and so therefore there's no need for an extensive ramp, for example.
But I think that this piece of the act is a codification of one of the things that a wildlife manager managing a unit discussing the development of it would take into consideration. How do I provide access and use of this with the minimum effect on the natural environment? Minimum effect. So that's the key when they're putting together how they're going to access and allow people to get into the unit. Is that correct?
That is correct. Thank you. And the last slide is just a quick summary of the Husker Heritage Funds that have that have gone into WMAs, and that includes protection, restoration, and enhancement. And that total after five appropriations is just under $48 million.
There's no other questions for Bob. We'll move on to aquatic management area.
Yes, I have a question.
Welcome.
This is Elizabeth. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, thank you. My concern when reading over this and then also reading over with Pat Tony and what they had proposed to do is the conflict that I see with the purpose of the retired stands up for Heritage Council as far as habitat is concerned. We don't have anything in our charge that says we need to be concerned about access, public recreation, and what people want. We are charged with more habitat concerns. We're not focused on plant and animal life, the health of the ecosystem. So we're really dealing with a different thing in some respects than what the state is when they purchase land for sale. Some of those are definitely and need to definitely be with people in mind and what the recreational needs are. But we really aren't charged with this. So I think that's where the conflict comes in. And I think if we look to the future and future purchases, in my mind, it would be looking for purchasing property where it is the least intrusive, where we will have the most opportunity to work with plants, critters, and the land versus people. There is another part of the sales tax that goes to parks and trails, and they deal with people and access, and they should. But I don't think that is our charge. So that's just a personal opinion, and I'm happy to hear any arguments against that. So thanks for the.
Elizabeth, we're going to defer the discussion that you're bringing up until after the presentation that gives us the background on all the programs, if that's all right.
Well, that's fine.
Okay. Thank you. Denny, did you join us?
Stephen, I did, yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, council members, for the record, my name is Martin Jennings, Section of Fisheries at the DNR. Aquatic management areas are established to protect, develop, and manage lakes, rivers, streams, and adjacent wetlands and lakes that are critical for fish and other aquatic lakes for water quality and for their intrinsic biological value, public fishing, and other compatible outdoor recreational uses. They're managed to perpetuate or reestablish high-quality aquatic habitat for the production of fish, wildlife, and other aquatic species. And both of those two bullets are out of Subdivision 14 of the 86A. So I'm going to briefly go over the breakdown of the types of properties we have as aquatic management areas. So the numbers you see in the first bullet are actually the number of parcels included as aquatic management areas, and an individual AMA can consist of several parcels. So what we actually have is 732 distinct aquatic management areas. 183 of those consist of easements, which provide access for anglers as well as access for farming management activities. We have 266 general use AMAs, and a general use AMA is open to fishing, hunting, and trapping. We have 69 fee title restricted use AMAs, and these are areas where hunting can be restricted because of local ordinance or incompatibility with the area. And then we have a number of properties that were designated as AMAs under 86A Subdivision 14 Paragraph E, and that is any existing properties that were administered by the fisheries program prior to this were established as AMAs. So this would include northern pike spawning marshes. It might also include water control structures and even grounds of DNR facilities, the grounds around hatcheries and things like that. And there's just over 200 of those included in the DNR system. So again, easements protect habitat and allow access, but not other recreational activities. Fee title are open to other recreational uses. And we have a quick breakdown of outdoor heritage funding of AMAs, and as in the, it, just like the wildlife management areas, this includes protection, restoration, and enhancement.
Okay.
Do AMAs also require county approval before designation, as proposed by the commissioner?
Mr. Chair, council member, they don't.
Other questions on AMAs? Great. Thank you. Next, we'll move into scientific and natural areas, and Peggy Booth can speak about those a little bit.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Peggy Booth, who supervises the Scientific and Natural Area Program. The Scientific and Natural Areas were initially established in 1969 through the statute, and then when the Outdoor Recreation Act came into effect, we became part of that Outdoor Recreation Act. So this first bullet is how SNAs are defined in the Outdoor Recreation Act. They're established to protect and perpetuate in an undisturbed natural state those natural features which possess exceptional scientific and recreational value. In addition to 86A, we have the peatland SNAs, which are established in statute, and there's also a statute that sets forth how we acquire SNAs or how we establish SNAs. They may be on lands that the state has in fee, conservation easement, or a lease. And we do, that same statute does require us to get county board approval. So to date, there are 159 SNAs across the state that encompass about 184,000 acres, and their purpose is largely to be managed for native plant communities and supporting high-quality wildlife habitat. And I might say, I didn't put it down here, but there is also a line in our statute, in the Outdoor Recreation Statute, that says that development shall be limited to the minimal amount necessary for education and interpretive purposes. So we are guided in rules by Minnesota Rule 6136, and they further elaborate that SNAs are places that, are to protect these natural resources. And there is in that a list of activities that are not allowed on SNAs. The things that are allowed automatically on SNAs are activities like hunting, bird watching, nature photography, snowshoeing.
Thank you.
However,
not hunting, hiking.
Hiking. Did I say hunting?
I think so.
I apologize. Hiking. What the rules say is that through designation order, we can allow other activities that are prohibited in those rules, which does include hunting, trapping dogs, and other uses, if we do that by designation order. So when we initially establish a new SNA, we are allowed to go through what uses are appropriate on that SNA, and if we have an existing SNA that we want to change uses on, then the statute requires us to go through a public hearing process. So all of the SNAs that we have acquired fee lands through outdoor heritage funding, we have through our designation orders assured that we allow all hunting and fishing and taking, trapping and taking of game during the open season. Go ahead. So this reflects the amount of funding that we've had for protection, restoration, and enhancement through the outdoor heritage funding. Thank you.
Questions? Ron.
I'm just curious. I'm sure I've probably been by or walked on scientific and natural areas, but I'm still, what qualifies as one that you would be interested in? What qualities would that land have?
Council member, Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Within the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, we have a group called Minnesota Biological Survey that evaluates and conducts surveys and gathers information on lands across the state. So they map native plant communities, they identify where there are rare species, and they put together reports that are called ecological evaluations. So for a parcel to qualify as SNA, it needs to be predominantly native plant community. Usually it would contain habitat for or presence of rare species, and it has to be recommended for SNA in one of these ecological evaluation reports.
Rob, I follow up, Mr. Chair. I see your funding has gone down considerably. Is that a reflection on the fact that maybe we've protected as many SNA areas as we need to, or are there many out there that need more protection?
Council member, Mr. Chair, in legislative session 10, there was an appropriation for both work on forest lands and on prairie lands. So that includes two different appropriations that had money for acquisition and enhancement work on a broader range of habitat types. In NL 11, it also included work on for acquisition and restoration enhancement of prairies, and so there were two different appropriations that the council approved that included that broad range. In NL 12, the proposal that we had for acquisition was not approved by the council, so there was no acquisition money, and there was no forestry money in NL 11, 12, or 13. And so NL 12 only represents restoration enhancement of prairie. In NL 13, that is acquisition, restoration, enhancement, but the majority of our acquisition money in NL 13 went to Native Prairie Bank, which our program administers but are not part of Scientific Naturalists. And yes, there is a lot of need still.
Do you want to describe inventory of needs?
Well, the goals that the Scientific and Natural Area Program has is that examples of every native plant community and rare species in each part of the state should be protected. And we have done a gap analysis of that, and in most subsections in the state, there's probably on the order of 15 to 20% of the native plant communities in that subsection that have protection by SNAs. We are in the process of doing a strategic plan that's going to identify the priority areas for us, but when the SNA program was initially established, there was a estimate that about 500 SNAs across the state would be needed to protect the range of species and plant communities we have. So we're about a third of the way there.
Great, thanks.
I might add while Richard's coming down that SNAs are often established from 10 other units. So you find SNA within a state forest and SNA within something other, another unit. And it's the only ORA unit that I know of offhand that's on private land, which is unique.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Richard Peterson with the Division of Forestry, and I'm sitting in here for Dave Schuler, who is our lands coordinator within the Division of Forestry. As I was looking in Chapter 89 for a very succinct purpose statement for State Forest, I did not find one. There's lots of other stuff in that chapter. The closest I came was what I put down here. State Forests are established, maintained, and protected for forestry purposes, including economic, environmental, and social purposes, using principles of multiple use and sustained yield of forest resources. There is some 3.8 million acres of forest land administered by the Division of Forestry. About 75% of those are part of one of 58 state forests throughout the state, primarily in the central and northern part of the state. There's an additional 722,000 acres that are administered by the division that are outside the boundaries of established state forests. And general uses of state forests are listed there. Forest management, including timber sales and reforestation, roads and trails. We have a variety of leases, including surface and mineral leases, and, of course, outdoor recreation in many facets. State forests are managed for the sustainable production of timber and other forest products, provide for outdoor recreation, fish and wildlife habitat, and watershed purposes. We have some 2 million acres plus of trust fund lands that are administered as part of our responsibilities, and I've included a management purpose there. Trust acres are managed for maximum long-term economic return consistent with the fiduciary responsibilities imposed by the trust relationship established in the Minnesota Constitution in conjunction with sound natural resource conservation and management purposes.
Mr. Chairman, just on that point, well, since Richard Vaughn, it's important to realize that school trust lands are commingled within all of the units of the Outdoor Recreation Act. And actually, we're just releasing a report that was required that identifies the number of acres, where they are, and the cost of buying out the trust and the threats that those units are under. For example, we're looking at shoreland or riparian lands that are school trust fund land that could be an AMA, but because of development or roads, power, utilities close by, probably should be sold on the open market to provide revenue for the trust. So I'm hopeful that if you find time, you'll be able to take a look at that. We'll have a short presentation on that, but for sure we will make sure that you see the link to that report, because it will be driving some land use and land conservation issues in the future. So thank you.
State forests are managed under Chapter 6100 of the rules, and that chapter addresses a whole variety of uses that are allowed on state forest lands. Virtually all non-motorized pedestrian uses and other uses, including hiking, skiing, horseback riding, and biking, camping, including dispersed camping. We have a number of state forest campgrounds that are administered by the Division of Parks and Trails, the on forestry administered lands. And there are a variety of motorized uses that occur on state forest lands, everything from off-highway motorcycles, ATVs, four-wheel drives, and those uses are relegated or regulated based on the state forest classification, whether it's a managed, limited, or closed forest, and the motor use designation for that particular trail. And just to emphasize, all state forests are open to public hunting and trapping, and there has been, according to Dave, a single appropriation for state forest land acquisition by the Outdoor Heritage Fund.
Mr. Chairman, state forests are probably the most open units of the Outdoor Recreation Act that we have, is providing for multiple use and access. WMAs and SNAs are probably the most restrictive if you look at it on a hierarchical basis. But it's important to remember, and I'm sure I know most of you, or all of you realize this, is that our forest management activities provide some of the best habitat for many of the species in the state, and that active forest management. Deer, grouse, songbirds, everything that's out there that comes with it is an important part of what we do. It's other states that don't have timber markets or active forest management
have a host of problems, from invasive species to wildfire and things like that. So we're very fortunate. It's a high priority for the department to maintain that strong timber industry, but also active forest management that provides many, many benefits to the outdoor community.
Bill? So what is it that allows you to manage a piece of property or habitat and extract the electricity uses like motorized trails or timber? How can you do that?
How do we administratively do that or physically do it on the ground? We, well, in terms of our timber management, those occur through our subsection forest resource management plan. So the state is divided into ecological subsections, some 15 or more, and each of those subsections that contain state forest lands have a forest management plan that addresses vegetation management within that unit, or within those units of that subsection. And so that addresses that component. That planning process, that state or subsection planning process, does not address other types of uses. For example, recreation trail uses are done through a separate planning process, and we're currently undergoing what we're calling phase two of forest trail planning and designation within the department right now. We've completed the first set of it in Pine County, four forests that are within Pine County, and hope to make it through the remaining in the next several years. So I guess to answer your question, Bill, there's a variety of different things, planning processes and other processes that go on to fully implement all the activities that take place on the state forest lands.
It's that interdisciplinary coordination amongst divisions that allow those activities to take place. We have a 15 forest resource kind of integration team that ecological waters, resources, fish and wildlife, and forestry staff sit on and meet on a regular basis. The other thing that kind of validates and really shows that we're doing the right thing is our forest certification process. We go through an annual process with two independent verifiers that look at every aspect of our forest management and forest recreation activities and certify that they're done sustainably. Now that's done so that the harvesters of that wood can advertise that or can market that wood to buyers such as Time Warner, who wanted to buy certified lumber. They only want to buy timber that is from sustainably managed forests. So that's a huge, huge factor in the driving of our management activities. And we've been very successful at maintaining that dual certification for many years now.
And among the things that are being sustained is habitat?
Habitat concerns are addressed in a number of ways, but certainly part of our management requires that we adhere to the site-level guidelines for sustainable forest management, and those site-level guidelines include, among other things, habitat management prescriptions. We also, again, as Bob alluded to, work in an interdisciplinary fashion with our Division of Wildlife to prescribe activities that not only benefit forestry per se, but forest wildlife. And so these subsection forest plans that I talked about earlier, those are done with an interdisciplinary group that includes wildlife, fisheries, eco-waters staff, as well as forestry staff, and putting together a plan that addresses not just the timber requirements of that subsection, but also the wildlife requirements, rare species requirements, etc.
Okay.
Thank you. Slide number three has the land management units listing state SNAs, wilderness areas, forests, WMAs, Wild Scenic Recreation Rivers and AMEs. And from the previous presentation, there are 184,000 acres in the SNAs, 3.8+ million acres of state forest, 1.3 WMAs, and 42,000+ SNAs. Can you give me the totals of the acreage in the wilderness areas? I'm just trying to rank them in terms of size and get them lined up in my mind as in terms of access, you know, lot to little. SNAs on the bottom, or wilderness on the bottom, I'm assuming. So what are the acreages of the wild wilderness areas and wild scenic and recreation? And, of course, that's a linear measurement, I imagine.
Mr. Chairman, members, the wild and scenic I can get for you. We do not have any officially designated wilderness areas. The Boundary Waters Canoe Area is a designated wilderness area, and actually the school trust fund lands, I should take that back. School trust fund land holdings within the Boundary Waters Canoe Area are, by statute, classified as state wilderness areas. While they're protected under the federal framework, they're considered. There's a statutory reference that says they are wilderness areas. So we don't have any designated wilderness, state wilderness areas, but we have the waters of Boundary Waters. I can't even think of the size of it right now. But all of the state, the school trust holdings within the BWC are designated as state wilderness areas.
And that's two within each section.
It gets a little bit more complicated than that, but there's I want to say, I'm not going to say because
I don't know.
But we are working with the U.S. Forest Service to do a land exchange to get those school trust fund lands.
Right.
Out of BWC, that's a long process, but we are making progress.
Yeah, that's been going on for a while.
We can provide the committee, to the council, with a hierarchical list of units and acreages. And also, I think it would behoove you all to have the appropriate rules and statutory references in some kind of reference document as you're going forward with recommendations.
This helps me a lot.
So we can work with council to get that. Going.
When the act was written, there was one wilderness area. And over time, opposition to wilderness changed the name of it. I'll have to find out what it is. There was one, which is why we have the.
So I just have a question in terms of your management. What's your view in terms of state forest management in the face of climate change and potentially your forests being savannas and not very foresty?
Well, I mean, there are high-level teams within the department that are addressing climate change and the implications it will have on all of our vegetation that we administer. There are currently working with one of our easement owners and the U.S. Forest Service to develop climate adaptive management that will address what is anticipated to be changes in climate that will impact the future of the forest. So it is using the best science to.
What I'm asking is, if the forest isn't the forest anymore in 100 years, what are you going to do with it?
Mr. Chairman, that's a very good question, and it's one that I think we're addressing through our reforestation activities and our state nursery activities, making sure that we're actively managing those forests as that succession line changes. We've presented to the legislature several times slides that some researchers show what the forest will look like in 100 years, and it is rather dramatic. But we are trying to make sure that as that succession occurs, we are growing adaptive species within our nurseries and planting them that are compatible for that change to occur. So it's gradually we're making sure that we're doing that, but it's, the oak savanna line will go way up, and Bob knows, Mr. Anderson knows this pretty well, but The challenges are the changing forests up there. We also have the invasive species issues that we're dealing with gypsy moth and emerald ash borer, what that will do to those forests in the North Shore and in northern Minnesota as well.
I think that the important thing to observe is that there's a spectrum of units, and you can accommodate the changed resource by putting it under a different management scheme.
And most likely the state forest management scheme will provide whatever we need to do, actually. It's the most flexible and provides the most opportunity for not only recreation but conservation and habitat protection as well. Okay. Mr. Chairman, we have a couple slides to talk about the master planning, and I'm going to do my best to get through those. And I wanted to bring up an example that we have in the staff person who worked on it. But we talked briefly about master planning, and it is in statute. And it does require a fair amount of activities. And what it does, it provides that long-range vision that guides development of facilities and management resources. And we do this through leadership and facilitation, pulling together advisory groups, and then there's a lot of public involvement with citizen advisory committees, open houses, and public review. It can take a long time, a year or more to do, sometimes more than that, but I wanted to just highlight and bring up Mr. Templeton and talk a little bit about the Lake LaSalle State Recreation Area, because this is a unit that the council had worked on in its initial years. It was a high-profile acquisition. It's an entire lake area. We purchased the whole lake and surrounding land around it. But when it was moving forward, people wanted to carve it out as a WMA on one side and there's an SNA across the road, but they wanted to create these other units, state park, wildlife management area. And because of the conflicting rules, not conflicting, the confusing rules that are out there for each of the units, we didn't want a person to be inside of this area and run across a sign that says WMA, this is allowed, that's not allowed, or in a park, this is allowed, that's not allowed. So what we did is we classified it as a state recreation area, and within the master plan process, worked on those values. So I'm going to let Mr. Templeton talk a little bit about how that works and actually the process that we use there.
Thank you. Again, for the record, my name is Jade Templeton. I'm a planner with the Division of Parks and Trails, Department of Natural Resources. And as Bob was saying, LaSalle Lake is a little bit unique, not so much in the resources it provides, not that they aren't unique, with a very deep lake, a full watershed nearly, that between Itasca State Park and the SRA has some ability for us to manage both within the department but also cooperatively with county forest land surrounding this unit almost in its entirety. Just a little bit about the broad range of department values that we're trying to express with this unit. As Bob said, this was a cooperative effort between Division of Parks and Trails and Fish and Wildlife and the SNA program, and really a leadership by the regional management team within the department to bring these different management goals together, these different recreational activities, these different habitat goals and preservation goals that are expressed throughout the department, and make those work together on one piece of property. One way that this happened was through collaborative planning. And as Bob has been saying, and we talked about a little bit previously, the idea that a management plan is a required element for a unit like an SRA in statute comes forward. But in this case, it came forward in a little different way, in that it came actually in two pieces. First of all, a group was brought together within the department to work on the natural and cultural resource goals and objectives for this unit, and that's the key with this, is the collaboration between the different units within the department getting together and finding ways to manage this property that would express all those values, whether it's hunting, fishing, or camping, or wildlife, or timber management, or restoration of habitat, management of the lake and fisheries within the lake as well. So that first group developed a long-range resource management plan that has specific goals and objectives for the land and the different aspects of the property. And that is being pushed forward through work planning that is overseen by the regional team. So it isn't that a plan was written collaboratively and then sits on the shelf. That's a plan that's written collaboratively and is being implemented collaboratively at the regional level. With the development of that resource management plan, the second step that was undertaken was the development, whether it be for at least parks and trails, a more traditional master plan, and that guides the recreational use, the development of facilities, the management of resources throughout the property. So having had this recreational foundation and collaborative foundation built, the other layer on how we deal with public access and the facilities both that were present on the property when we purchased it, but also the plans for the rehabilitation or additional facilities for this land. And I think that the key to making this work and making it work going forward is that collaboration doesn't stop with plan, that collaboration within the department, especially at the regional level, continues forward with how the areas manage, how the divisions set their budgets, and spend money and resources on these properties and work together to make decisions on how the land is managed going forward. And again, as Bob mentioned, one of the keys to this is seamlessness as much as possible, not only within the department, but also for the visiting public. So the SRA is bounded, as you can see, hopefully you can see on that slide, and the shaded area to the north is the SNA. So there's two units represented, and as Mr. Becker also reminded us, the frequency of SNAs, especially as secondary units, within other units, that the SNA boundary as a whole, and the SRA boundary as a whole and the SNA within it. The department's worked very hard in how it's establishing its rules and how it's guiding public use to minimize barriers, to minimize the concern of what activities are allowed where. And this has been an exercise, again, that the department has gone through in using the redesignation of the SNA to allow some of those activities or to be more clear about what activities are allowed in the SNA as well as the SRA in its entirety, as well as working on permits and access. That permits that are typical within SRAs or state parks for camping or entrance fees and things like that are only being collected and only required at facilities such as the campground and the day use area, but hunting access to the lake for fishing, things of those natures don't require a permit. So the department's been working very hard through its management, both of the resources as well as public access, to make this work as best as possible.
Questions? Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity. I hope we were able to scratch the surface on the outdoor recreation compatible uses and habitat. And, you know, there's a lot of things that are possible if you think creatively and stay within the constitutional confines that you have, but that multiple use aspect is something that I hope we can try to figure out how to do that with the constitutional statutory framework that you all are faced with, because from our perspective it helps the acceptance of these lands, and if we're ever going to achieve the success of accomplishing the prairie plan, for example, it's going to have to be with a lot of partnerships and a lot of support, not only at the county level, but at the local level and at the citizen level, and being a little bit flexible at times works a lot better than the honey works better than the stick a lot of times. So we're trying to figure out how to do that, and we'll be working with you all in the future to try to figure that out as well.
And I'd like to say that listening to this, it's clear that all the units that have been presented today have a habitat objective. They're different. Some are more pure. But they all provide habitat for fish, game, and wild.
That is one of the main goals. And water quality. I mean, you cannot forget water quality as well.
All right. So we want to bring Josh down just real quick.
Ron, do you have a question?
Yeah, just real quick. Yeah.
We're running late.
Yeah, okay. Bob, and this is maybe a day for another discussion, but you, under your land management units, you have Wild Rivers. So I'm curious about, there are rules about, for people living on that Wild River, about, like trees they can't cut down, size of trees. Okay, that's all great. But this summer, in Anoka County, there was a huge development on the Rum River where they bulldozed down 100-year-old oaks right on the shore, cleared down a hillside, and now they're building big houses there, and they're going to put in a public dock on the river. So I got really curious about that, and this was Andover and the Anoka County were pushing for this. And I said, well, this is a wild river. How can you be bulldozing down 100-year-old oak trees? And the answer was, DNR gave us permission to do it. So my question is, maybe just being a good guy there, I don't know, but who decides in your department that you can forget the rules of the Wild Rivers Program?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would need to look into, and I will look into the specifics of that and get back to you on it, but there are processes and procedures that allow for those variances to occur. Ultimately, the commissioner is responsible for the actions of the department, so I'll get back to you on that, but there's different processes in different places, and the Wild and Scenic River is a little bit complicated because it's a federal designation with easements that have been purchased and things like that. So
this is a state wild river, though, I think.
Okay, I just need, Mr. Chairman, I'll do a little research and get back to you on that question.
Other questions? If not, thank you all for
coming
in today and helping us understand the complexity of your system. Do you want to come down?
So, staff promised to ask Josh to come and be present and answer questions. Josh represents a county that manages county boards. We talked earlier about the parallel. So just very briefly, Josh, how you have similar rules, regulations, intermixed forest management ownership, and how you came to conclude that this is not an unintended use in terms of the ABB issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. Excuse me. For the record, my name is Josh Stevenson. I'm the land commissioner for Cass County. To address your question, Mr. Becker, Cass County has maybe a more unique way of dealing with these types of social questions in that we don't feel we are the best person or agency or the state of Minnesota, for that matter, is to make those types of decisions. We rely very heavily on the public input. This particular question that came up with this particular piece of property is going through a public input process. In fact, that process ended, as you probably are aware, on January 24th. And the input that we received from the cities, the townships, and the people that live along these routes were that they weren't happy with a designated ATV trail in this area. So for this particular question, the Gratinade ATV trail proposal application has been tabled. And the reason it was tabled was not because of what the county thought or what the state of Minnesota thought, who was a very interactive partner in going through this public input process. It was what the people that live in that area that make our decisions and run our program thought. Roads and access, in general, are a very important part of our decision-making process as to whether or not we want to acquire a piece of property. It's part of our transparent approval process with townships and the people that live in that area. And quite frankly, an existing forest access road for the movement of forest products and people to access existing public land is one of the main reasons we look at parcels. Forest access roads are required for us to follow our Forest Resource Management Plan, which was written by the public. It's written by the taxpayers of Cass County, which includes not only full-time residents, but a lot of people that own recreational property in our county. The existing forest access roads that we often inherit were placed in an area with the least resistant. So
just about all of them are built on high, dry areas. They don't go through wetlands. They don't go through lakeshore. They're not on the lakeshore itself. They go through areas where can I get a semi that's full of wood through here without breaking the mirrors off, without sliding off a hill and wrecking something or getting hurt. That's where these roads were placed. And a lot of them were built right around the turn of the century, between 1900 and 1920, the first time the forest was managed. This continual use has been going on for now over 100 years of a lot of these routes, and the ones that weren't built in a good place, nobody used them anymore, so the forest absorbed them, and they're very hard to find. The ones that were used in good places are the ones that we continue to move products on today. Another aspect of this, too, there's a lot of talk about habitat, that whether you want to be in the human habitat business or not, if you are managing public land, you have to consider humans as one of your wildlife species that are going to use the property. If you don't, you pretty much don't have a land asset management program, is what it comes down to. That the public's access to their own property has to be part of the discussion. And I recognize some of the concerns of this council and the way the statute's written, that it may not be your problem or something that this council is not charged with, but I do appreciate the fact that you're having this discussion, because for us, in the way that we run our program, it's a major part of how we make a decision as to whether or not a piece of property qualifies for something that we want to own.
Thank you. So let me just sort of summarize where I think this affects us. Clearly what we've already agreed to, we've agreed to in our accomplishment plans, and what has been appropriated by the legislature. If there are concerns in this regard in terms of what type of access to parcels that we want to raise going forward, we need to think about that both when we're going through the process to make our recommendations and in the accomplishment plans. We really can't look back and change anything. Elizabeth, I thank you for bringing up the issue so that we can all think about it more clearly. This is a process of clarification and understanding as we go forward. And Josh, thank you for your helping us understand your perspective on this and how you go through it. And there will be people on the council and other places who agree with you and disagree with you, but I appreciate the forthright way you handle this. Are there any questions for Josh right now? Thanks for making the trip. I know you got here early, which meant you got up really early. So
Thank you. You didn't
really have to, so I apologize for that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the council. And again, thank you for all the work that you do. This program is a major part of our land asset management program today. We have been able to, again, open up thousands of acres of existing public land by buying strategic parcels like this one that's being discussed in this letter that had existing forest access on it. And one of the main, before we even talked to this seller, who, just in case you're interested, we've been in communication with this particular seller for 7 years on this parcel. Before the council was even formed, we were talking to this person about the potential of buying this property. And we did not dream that up. That was strictly brought to us by members of the public that said, "Hey, I've noticed this piece of property is for sale. It's got a realtor sign on it. This is how I've gotten to town on my four-wheeler or in my Jeep or on foot or on skis or on my snowmobile since I was a little kid. Is there anything that the county can do to ensure that continues to happen? I don't want to see this property bought. I don't want to see houses built in there and the road closed. We like it the way it is. That's pristine lakeshore. It's pristine habitat. This connects a piece of state of Minnesota property to U.S. Forest Service property to tax forfeit property, and the community is the one that brought this to our attention, that this is a piece of property that we should really look at trying to acquire. So again, thank you to the council and all the members for allowing us to do what the public asks and acquire pieces of property like this. So thank you.
Members, I was reminded by Susan that we didn't approve the minutes, so we need to do that. And Sandy, I'd like first a motion to approve the minutes of our last meeting, and then we'll call the roll.
So moved.
Sandy, will you call the roll?
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Representative Hanson?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Representative McNamara? Sue Olson?
Yeah.
Yes.
Ron Chera?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins?
Yes.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes. Okay. Sorry about the little slip up there. Next, we have two amendment requests. I'm going to try to make up a little time here. Bill, if you can just summarize them, and perhaps we can handle them quite differently.
The first one is an amendment to the Minnesota Law for 2011, first special session, 6-1-2-D, DNR restoration and enhancement. This was a situation where DNR, without getting council approval in their accomplishment plan, made a capital equipment purchase of how many thousands of dollars is this? $24,000. They discovered it. It was in closed books. They came to us for a retroactive amendment. We declined as staff to schedule to bring it in front of you. DNR came back to us and said, we're going to open up the books if we can and change the accounting. To move things fast here, I think what we need to do, there were a few other items in the amendment, quick motion to approve the amendment to change the partial list, I believe it is.
There are also several budget changes, timeline changes.
And would you like to go through the budget changes real quick?
Are they of any significance for a few thousand dollars one way or the other?
They're significant.
Okay, then please go through them.
If you turn your attention to page 6 of the council plan question, you'll see that there's a change in the personnel from $930,000 to $630,000. Contracted line item is a slight increase, or not slight increase, an increase of $100,000 from $604,000 to $703,000. Travel has increased significantly from $42,000 to $105,000. Other equipment and tools, a slight change from $20,000 to $32,000, and then again another significant increase in supplies and materials from approximately $15,000 to $140,000.
So what we need is a motion that addresses the budget changes, either positively or negatively, and requests a notification of the council when the capital equipment accounting is corrected.
Mr. Chair, if I may, too, that this amendment is also requested to be retroactive, which I think is also a significant change to the beginning of the availability of the appropriation.
Thank you for pointing that out. So basically, personnel goes down, but contracts go up. And travel is increased, and supplies and materials are increased. The total amount stays the same. And this is retroactive. The request is for retroactive. What do you want to do?
make a motion.
Then I guess we're not approving the change. There's no motion to do so.
I move to approve it.
Okay. Any discussion? Ron?
Was there any explanation why these numbers changed so drastically? Or
it's in the letter.
I wasn't here for the last meeting.
It's in the letter.
It's in the letter?
Yeah.
Okay. I haven't had time to read that.
Rick?
Do we have any other of these?
Of this type, not that I know of.
We, on a regular basis as staff, approve minor changes, including changes in budget. As of the last 6 months, we've been very concerned about changes in personnel and professional services and have erred on the side of bringing them to you. And we'll continue to do that. And we will obviously bring any significant retroactivity requests to you. And the law requires you to approve capital equipment specifically, so we would bring that to you.
And capital equipment is anything that has a life of 5 years or greater?
Bond council, actually it's a 20-year life. But we talk about $10,000 or more equipment.
Well, to add to my motion, you know, in reading the letter, it as much as I don't like to see this sort of thing, I think that they have taken quite a bit of time to analyze what happened and work at preventing it from happening again, which I surely hope is the case, because this is looks sloppy. But in reading what they've done and how they've addressed it, I would expect not to see something like this again. To me, bottom line didn't change, but it was poor planning or poor communication or lots of different things that added up to a lot of changes that should be very uncharacteristic.
I imagine that message will be
understood. I imagine.
Any other comments? Sandy, will you call the roll?
Joan Shara?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins?
Yes.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
No.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Sue? Yes.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
8-1.
All right, motion passes. Next, we have a minor amendment as a result of road activity. Bill, do you want to just quickly?
As you know, we have extensive easement over 1,000 parcels and nearly 200,000 acres with the planned incorporation in northern Minnesota. From time to time, counties, for safety purposes or other reasons, change the alignment of roads in effect that easement. I think we have brought these before you in the past. We're bringing this one in front of you. There's some things about this that I think are peculiar or unique, and that you might want to discuss and give the staff authorization to do these on a routine basis. But let's talk about this one. It is a safety issue. The county has eminent domain, which they're not using. They're not condemning the property. They could if they wanted to. It's routine. There wouldn't be a way to stop it. And they've agreed to repay the Outdoor Heritage Fund our share of the compensation that goes to the county. So the fund is whole. The easement stays on the land, so whatever habitat there is protected under the easement.
What's most important, I think, from the council's point of view is that these are safety issues. And these are a thing to complain when they come to us. And I'd like to know whether you all want to see them in the future or just be notified. We're happy to do it either way. And we need a motion to approve this, which I think is a pro forma request.
I'd like to continue to see them, and I move to approve this particular one. It's just east of the Sink Highway, and there aren't very many close neighbors, if any. I assume that there would have been incidents at that intersection. Well, it's not even an intersection, I don't think. I think it's just a right angle turn. It's just moving on a turn.
Right.
But I would like to see them.
Would you like to see them or see them and approve them?
See and approve.
Okay, I'm just clarifying.
Thanks.
Any discussion on this particular one? Rick?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Becker, is this the fifth alteration to the land easement?
Four.
And do we anticipate any others?
I'm hard pressed to express how much I anticipate this. Yes.
I think it's a matter of when, not if.
And many.
How many acres?
187,000. Any other questions?
I'd be surprised if there weren't.
Sandy, call the roll, please.
Sue Olson?
Yes.
Ron Chera?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins?
Yes.
Representative McNamara?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Chair Hartwell?
Yes.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Motion passes. Other thoughts on the vote here? Do you want to see these or approve them, or is this the right mix of how to handle these kinds of things? Bob, you're nodding. I think this is the right way. Anyone disagree with having these come to us for approval? Okay, that's what we'll do.
And I might come in for your nighttime reading the excerpt of the council procedures on land acquisition restrictions and how we implement the statute. And any alterations or changes that you think are necessary for that, bring the staff's attention, and we'll filter up.
Okay. Next, Jim, you and Scott, so you.
Scott's not
here. You're going to talk to us a little bit on a recommendation for direct support services.
Okay, well, as you remember at the last meeting, Scott and I felt we should bring a little more clarity to our direct support services. We were under the impression that we could come up with a standardized procedure that all the groups could use so that the system was a little more standardized and everyone was working on pretty much the same playing field. Well, it didn't take us very long to figure out that, you know, we were trying to put a square peg in a round hole. So we decided to take a different approach that maybe would solve the problem and something everybody could live with. So if you just look at the handout, the first page where it just describes the how money should be appropriated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and it says as long as specific appropriations are specified in the accomplishment plan. So Scott and I felt, well, maybe that's the best way to do it, if we could just specify these expenses a little more clearly in the accomplishment plan, we could solve the issue for everybody. So on the next page, we just took a couple excerpts from the MMB's guidance on legacy fund expenditures, which I think legitimizes these expenses and gives an overall view on how they're to be documented and defended. The next page is just a couple examples of how some of the groups now calculate their indirect expenses. These are a little blurry, but it just gives an idea of some of the different metrics that different groups use. A couple things I just want to point out is if you look at the first one, and it's, again, hard to see, but the DNR, this is the method they use for the LCCMR. They haven't used this method with us, but they assign a metric to each FTE. How they arrive at that, I'm not sure, but that's the method they use to come up with their direct support services. The next page is the one that on DNR grasslands. These are not necessarily real appropriations. These are examples, but the DNR takes these expenses two times for each division. That they take it for the division and the department. So the division might take 4.4%, and the department might take 2%. So they're actually taking closer to 6% for each division. So there's a double charge there, if I don't know if that's the correct terminology.
What are those, what are the abbreviations over
the
left-hand column
there, Jim? Those are the divisions, ecological and okay. services, fish and wildlife, okay. so on and so forth.
Okay.
Then Nature Conservancy, this isn't really an example. This is how they come up with their indirect cost rate. Just do that as an example. But on the last page, this is a sheet we'd like to have put in the accomplishment plan. Basically, at the upper left-hand corner, we'll put the allocation in that was given and to the group. Then we would take away, and this number here is a number that we should probably make specific recommendations on so everyone's dealing from the same point, but feed title or pass-through grants or a single-source contract, something where there's little or no expense to the organization, we would take out of the appropriation, which would give us eligible costs. That these would be costs that would be eligible to receive support services. The next little section here just shows the different methods that we've seen people use, so we would know the method they're going to use to come up with these support services. Then the charts below that or the graph below that would be the rates that they're using, so we know what rate they're using, what indirect cost rate or what FTE metric. This next batch would be just the areas where they're trying to recover these costs, so they would show us where they're recovering these costs. And then at the bottom, we would come up with a number for their reimbursable support services. A lot of the groups, like Nature Conservancy, don't request them all. They use part of it as an in-kind match, so they would put that number there, the number that they're requesting. And then just kind of as a metric for the council themselves to just have an idea of the efficiency of maybe this project, we would put that number over their eligible costs. The legitimacy of that number depends on that eligible cost, because if somebody at the top decides not to take off their feed title acquisition, that number gets a lot bigger, so that number gets a lot smaller. So, but it's just a... It's just a way that you could look at the project and you have some idea of efficiency of how they've done business here. So that's the recommendation Scott and I have come up with, and we would like this page to be included in the accomplishment plan. So at least we would have some idea of where and how these charges were being developed.
In the accomplishment plan or in the proposal?
I think they're going to have to be in the accomplishment plan.
I thought you see it in the proposal.
Well, the only thing in the proposal, they don't really know what they're going to get.
No, but they know what
they're asking for. It would be a place to start. Does that bug you?
It doesn't bug me. I think it'd be just more realistic if it was an accomplishment.
Yeah, but this gets a
it starts getting into our vernacular a little bit better and, shows them what we're looking at. And have it in the adoption plan, too.
Other thoughts? All right, we're going to go into the RFP or the funding request, so that will be part of the discussion in the funding request as we move through this. Is that all right?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Scott.
That's okay.
Thank you, Scott.
No.
The next thing we thought we'd do, you do see in your packet a couple of letters on the draft request for proposal form for call. We thought it made sense to ask if there's any other comments that weren't submitted in writing before we get into a discussion of the actual call itself and what form it will take and hopefully approve it today. Please come forward and quickly give us your name and what your comment is, because we want to move on. But we want to hear what you have to say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the council. My name is Dominic Cerisi, and I'm the president of the Bay Lake Improvement Association. Bay Lake is located in Crow Wing County, and we have the Bay Lake Improvement Association has over 500 members. Our members care deeply about the lakes and all other lakes in Minnesota. We have been infested with Eurasian water milfoil for over two decades. We've had a lake management program on file with the DNR for over a decade, allowing us to treat pre-Eurasian water milfoil. And for over 3 years, we've been monitoring our public access for the past 2 years with Class 1 inspectors. We have encouraged successfully all other accesses on our lake to close to the public, and we monitor our public access from sunup till sundown, Memorial Day until Labor Day. Even with all our efforts to prevent further infestations, we know it is not enough, and we need your help. The purpose of the Outdoor Heritage Fund, as I understand it, is to restore, protect, and enhance habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. The Legacy Amendment passed with 42% of registered voters who backed the amendment, citing cleaning up and protecting Minnesota's lakes, rivers, and streams as the primary single reason for their vote. Other causes were cited by only 27% combined. The people of Bay Lake who have chosen me as a representative say it is time for the council to begin accepting RFPs for programs to battle the spread of aquatic invasive species. For some time, we have followed the debate on the council regarding this issue. We have heard that the amendment was not meant to fight AIS, but a plurality of Minnesotans believe that it was intended to do just that. And that is why they voted for the amendment. We have heard that the people of Minnesota are not ready to do what is necessary to fight AIS. To this we say that you were appointed to the council not to follow the people, but to lead on important issues dealing with our shared outdoor heritage, because you are considered leaders on outdoor issues. We have heard the DNR commissioner say it would take $500 million to adequately protect all lakes from AIS, specifically zebra mussels. To this we say, how much is spent in this state on lakes-related tourism? How many property tax dollars are brought into the revenue stream by second homeowners, the majority of whom own property on or near a lake in greater Minnesota? What will happen to these monies if our lakes are rendered unusable? We feel it is time for the council to begin to fund programs aimed at fighting AIS. Zebra mussels are just the beginning. Soon there will be more invasives threatening our waters. Minnesota is known as the land of 10,000 lakes. What better way for us to protect our shared legacy than by protecting our lakes? We need leadership from the council on this issue. Please ask for funding proposals to stop the spread of AIS in our state and to protect our lakes. I'm happy to answer any questions to the best of my ability, and I thank you for your time.
Yes, Jim. So what specifically would you do to Bay Lake?
Well, Bay Lake is in Crow Wing County. There are over 400 lakes in Crow Wing County, so I think it would be more of a township issue. There are about 10 lakes in the township with public accesses, and we've had conversations with the township about instituting some type of pilot program if the funding were available. We've raised considerable amounts of money, and we have over $200,000 stashed away to work on issues like this, so we'd be able to bring some money to leverage it. But I think we have to start with a program to see the effectiveness of...
Okay, well, we have a pilot program this year.
There's one. I think there need to be more spread throughout the state.
Okay, so again, specifically, what would you do to Bay Lake to protect it from AIS?
We need to have it monitored, the public access monitored, 24 hours a day in some shape, way, shape, or form, and that boats are inspected.
Private property and public property every form?
Right now, our public access is monitored, and the private accesses are chained up.
What about homeowners?
There's maybe two or three homeowners who can push a boat in, but most of it, any spot that we found on our lake that has an access, we've asked that it be chained up.
But you wouldn't have any authority to do that?
We do not have any authority now.
So it wouldn't be an impervious barrier around the lake?
You know, nothing in life is 100%, but we have pretty much about 95% coverage, and with an issue like this, I don't think you're ever going to find something that's 100%.
And are you a lake association, did you say?
Excuse me?
Are you a lake association?
Yes, Bay Lake Improvement Association.
Are those homeowners members?
We have over 500 members.
Are those homeowners on the lake members?
Yes. There are about 600 cabins on the lake, so we have, you know, 500 of the 600 families on the lake as members.
So you want us to monitor all those 10 lakes completely?
How it's implemented, we could go in and start putting forward proposals.
Well, if we're going to give money to something, we have to know what we're giving the money for.
The idea would be to have every public access monitored in some way, shape, or form. I don't know what that shape or form would be, but yes, it would be monitored 24 hours a day with a central decontamination station, which for us is located right at 6 and 8. There's a spot where we could do it. It's definitely a doable proposition. It just would take some money and some thought into how it would happen.
Okay. Rick?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cerisi, what I hear you saying is you're not here with a proposal. You're asking that the RFP consider AIS and that there be proposals for future programs in this next round. Is that what you're
saying? Exactly. I'm asking that the RFP call for proposals to fund AIS.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time.
Other comments? Going, going, gone. All right, members. Next, we want to talk about the approval of the fiscal year 16 call for request. I do specifically address your attention to the letters in your packet, which were comments on the draft that we put out. You have the draft in your packet as well. And so I do think one of the things that when I read the proposal, AIS is not mentioned specifically as it was in our past ones, but it is mentioned indirectly in terms of water quality. And so I'm seeing Susan nod, but was that when you guys worked on a revised piece, was that part of your discussion? So you're comfortable that AIS is included in this? If someone comes to us with a proposal, that?
Yes, and it's not excluded. I think what we discussed when we were in a working group was that by having the priority actions listed, it almost gave like an improper emphasis to everything else. We're not saying we don't want to see AIS. There was just the discussion that maybe there's no point in having priority things because it's already included in all of the sections.
Priorities by region.
Right.
Because I suspect you're here because you read the
draft and questioned whether or not AIS was something that was on the agenda for us, which is a legitimate question. So, and I thank you for bringing the question.
Good catch.
Do we want to specifically include AIS in each of the section descriptions as part of this, or are we comfortable that it's not excluded and it talks about habitat and quality, water quality, so it's included as it is?
At one point, we actually discussed possibly adding a bullet point in each of the sections to talk about invasive species, period, because there aren't just aquatic invasive species. You look at buckthorn and some of the vine things that are happening. I wouldn't have any objection to adding either AIS or invasive species all the way across the board, just so that people know that it's not excluded.
And see, I'm from the other side. I don't see any reason to state something that's implicit in what's already in there. It certainly is not excluded, and it certainly is not restricted to aquatics. So it should be out there like everything is out there.
I'm on the other side.
Which other side?
I'm on Jane's side. I'm not on Jane's side this time. Why not make things as clear as possible? You could say, this is under clean water, but a lot of invasive species have really no impact on the cleanliness of the water.
What about non-aquatics?
And invasive species covers everything. So I would suggest that we mention, consideration for invasive species. I think I had this talk about 3 years ago.
Rick, and I think kind of what we just had in terms of a presentation, we have someone from the public who looks through the document and doesn't see invasive species. So we could have potential partners out there who would apply who may not, they may be new or they may not see it. So I think the words should appear somewhere in there explicit so that there's not, and I would agree that it'd be terrestrial and aquatic, or I mean invasive species in general would cover that.
Okay, so I'm getting a sense here. We'll have to make a formal motion, but in a sense, Sue, you're probably okay with this. I'm hoping that we would direct staff to make mention of invasive species, both terrestrial and aquatic, just so that it's clear we're not excluding them. Jane?
And we did talk about this in our committee, too, and there's really no place to put it outside of each individual of the five, so we could put the same bullet item in the five. If you want to put more ink and paper out there, that's fine with me.
It's all electronic.
Right.
Okay, so I think we're at a consensus point on that issue. There were a couple of other comments that come in. You all have the letter from Trout Unlimited in front of you. Section 2, Item 4, concern with the 3-year time horizon. This, in my mind, falls into the same thing as a prairie restoration. You're weather dependent and a lot of other things. Do we want to just move that to a 5-year as we have in prairies instead of limiting it to 3? Bob, you're looking like you're thinking about it, and Ron is nodding.
Yes.
But you know, our main thrust in this was to get the work done.
Yeah.
And don't dilly-dally. And I don't think anybody's trying to do that. But that's why we tried to move it up to 3. But I think that John's point makes sense, and we should be responsive to that. So we could either do it on an exception basis, or we could stretch it out, or with 4 work. I mean, this is fungible, I think.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the second sentence there says specific programs may be extended to 5 years, so we do allow that. And so why do we need to make them all 5 years? I agree with the Councillor Kingston that we have to be pushing to get these done.
That's why we did it that way. And I don't think that would prohibit John's work. Do you think so, John? Does that just not work at all?
No.
I'm sorry, David, I should...
No, that's fine.
Mr. Chair,
just for the record, who you are.
For the record, my name is John Lincheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited. And to your question and point, currently the grants do allow 5 years to get the work done. My concern was that if it said it had to be fully completed within 3 years, maybe we would score lower. You look at our... It seemed to be a criteria that you had to be done within 3 years. And long as that is not how the proposal gets viewed, we're fine.
I don't think that's...
Typically, we're done within 3 years, but again, the native vegetation, especially in riparian areas where it floods up and down, it's a little trickier. So, no, it's been working fine. I just want to make sure we didn't get dinged for...
Just a clarification on this. This is our request for proposal. The actual bill allows 5 years. So this is what they're committing to us, that their intent is. So I think we're okay. I appreciate you bringing up the comment. Would you talk a little bit about your Section 3 Criterion 10 question?
I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me. So I'm thinking hard, John.
Yes.
Does the proposal fully describe and quantify in detail how the requested funding supplements and does not substitute customary or usual funding sources? Simplified budget for the like activities over 5 years since inception are required.
Yeah, I think my comment went to, that we would need to provide a budget for every project we've done in the last 5 years, which was how I was reading the... unless it's been removed. Again, I can't quite find it here.
No, it's in there.
It's there.
Simplified budget for every, project in the past 5 years, that could be kind of onerous. Was that within the organization in the state, both LSAR and non-LSAR? I mean, I think the intent was to get at, I guess my feeling would be more of a narrative description, which should be sufficient rather than trying to get budgets of all past projects.
And we were looking at what the statute says and what the constitutional amendment says about traditional sources of funding. And we want to get some kind of a feel for how the funding is managed. I'm not interested in looking at minutia, not one bit, but I'm interested in looking at ballpark, and I'm looking at trending and that sort of thing. And I don't think that should be too hard to put together.
Okay.
That's what I asked for in this.
I think there might be some confusion. I think where I might have some confusion is that's really a provision directed more to state government than it is to nonprofits.
Yeah.
And so because you can't, unless a nonprofit has been consistently getting money out of the state that they're trying to do, which isn't... We haven't seen much of that.
Yeah, I think that Scott brought that up in our discussion, and there may be an explanation for that, but I don't see what's wrong with asking the question.
Does staff have a thought on that? Rick?
Well, I think the problem would be a screen, be a filter of removing potential organizations who cannot go back since the beginning of time to find information, if it's either even 5 years or inception. Volunteer organizations having to pull that material up just to apply. I could see that could be a question that would be asked during vetting of the project, but that is a pretty big upfront hurdle to jump to even get into the game. And it is... The question of supplanting, I think, is you could ask, have you received what state-funded programs have you done, rather than your existing, but what they would be required to keep that for 7 years. You could probably ask to get that same through the DNR or the other agencies, because they would be distributing that money to them. And you could get those general balance sheets of what's gone out. But it could become a pretty big screen in terms of timing that has an effect on who applies and who doesn't.
Well, I don't think it's a screen. It wasn't intended as a screen. But
you know, so far we haven't paid any attention to that particular section of the language, and I think we should. Does it mean we should rule things in or out based on it? Not necessarily. We're proposing it on this as one of 12 criteria. So the range of, you know, values assigned to it are many. I guess to me the bigger question is, should we address this or should we just ignore it?
Ron? Yeah, what exactly are you asking applicants? What information are you asking for?
We're trying to get at supplanting versus, you know, what the language is in the law, in the Constitution, and in the statute.
Private groups can't be accused of supplanting, can they?
Well, if they got state funds, it could be anything. I don't know how they'd answer it. I don't know.
I guess I'm more concerned about maybe grilling them here about their past history.
Well, I'd like to put them on notice that this is something that's why I put it down as a criteria, that's something that if you ask them in a hearing, you're never going to get an answer. It's too complicated, and that's why I wanted to be upfront about it.
So let me propose an alternative, which is in the 10 as you have written it, we keep the first sentence in, which... Does the proposal fully describe and quantify in detail how the requested funding supplements and does not substitute customary or usually funding sources? Leave that in. See what comes to us. If it isn't enough, then go further next time through or the time after.
Yeah, I really do see this as this whole call and everything we're doing is trying
evolving.
To respond. It's I think it should be evolving all the time. Work in progress. So
okay.
I'd be happy with that. Would you?
That.
Mm-hmm. I want to see what happens.
Heather, what do you think? I didn't see you thinking down there,
Mr. Chair. But I just wanted to point members to the accomplishment plans and back to the proposals as well, because that currently is a question that is asked. And if the way the question is framed is, tell us how this program proposal accelerates or supplements current efforts. So there might be some question around, are they fully answering the question to your satisfaction? But the question is posed, and it really does vary across the different proposals as to how well and in what kind of detail that the way in which they answer that.
Right, and I didn't get, over the years that I've been serving, I didn't get much out of that.
And I think this is about the proposal versus the accomplishment plan.
Right, and the question is asking the proposal.
So... I'm seeing some nods that we can take the second part of that sentence out, or that paragraph out, if it makes sense. And timing, pointing out that we have a wrong date, thank you. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think, I'm recalling my comments, I don't have with me. I think the concern was with it being since inception, if that meant our organization having done little projects over the last 40 years, we don't have records of those budgets, and
you
so that was really the concern. But
well, now you don't have to worry about it at all.
Thank you.
So we also got a note from the Metropolitan Regional Park System implementing agencies. And my interpretation is that their interpretation was that restoration wasn't included. Or enhancement. And I guess I'm curious how other people read this.
We didn't even change that.
Yeah, we never changed any of the section things. Those are what we've had. So this is probably just they haven't brought it up before. Looking at their specific comments when they got down to the summary, they were requesting the word through fee and easement acquisition in the first sentence under Metro Urbanizing Division to come out. I think that makes sense because it is the only one that's called out that way, and it's probably just been there and no one's really looked at it.
Including you guys.
Well, this was way too big to look at this thing. We were like, no.
Would anyone object to taking out the through fee and easement acquisition since it's covered in other instruction? Kirk, I know you're here. Is that That's the sum of what you were looking for in your comments. All right. I'm seeing nods. Okay, members, those were the comments we got from outside, which was great to have other people reading our stuff and giving us advice.
We'll quickly come back and talk to staff to the section 2, number 4, and just make it clear that 3 years isn't a minimum screening criteria that you're open to 5 years or to a different period of time?
I think the suggestion of using substantial completion instead of just complete probably gets us there.
Okay. Thank you.
So you had other comments? I didn't catch that.
Mr. Chairman, members, Kurt Peterson with Rice, Michaels, and Walker representing the Campus Park Board and Metropolitan Parks Implementing Agencies. If you look at the just the final sentence, or kind of two sentences, paragraphs, I'm sorry, of our comments, there's one other kind of technical issue, and it's on how the upland habitat projects around upland lakes are worded. It seemed like there was kind of an incomplete sentence in the call dealing with waterfowl versus waterfowl production or waterfowl populations. It just, there was one sentence in that it didn't seem clear, and we kind of pointed that out just at the end of our comments. It looks like an oversight or kind of a typo drafting error, but it's something that's stood out for us.
Yeah, you're correct. It's in the center of the large paragraph, the second paragraph under Metro Urbanizing Vision, and it's also the very last sub-bullet point in the entire section on page 9.
So
waterfowl should be used as an adjective, and the nouns are missing.
Okay. Thank you for pointing out our grammatical error.
So the correction is?
In the first one, the sections game lakes will be significant contributors of waterfowl, I think, production. And the second one, game lakes are significant contributors of waterfowl. I guess either production or populations would work.
I think populations is a better word.
Yeah.
Okay. As members read through this, was there anything that came up that you read and went, oh, we missed that, or we should have changed something, or Rick?
One thing I was thinking could be included was the new provisions relating to the statutory pollinator requirements, to clarify those so that people are aware of them. They may not be aware of them, the statutory changes that occurred, and that could just be a box in there that those pollinator things require and cite the statute so that they're aware of them and that they incorporate them into their proposals.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone have a problem with that? So I'm not seeing anything else. What I'd love is a motion to adopt the call for request with the following changes. First, that staff be given the direction to include invasives in all of the regions, so it's clear that this is to deal with aquatic and terrestrial invasives. And if they want to do it in a bullet point or however, we'll let them do that. The second, that we add a little section on pollinators, just making it clear that that's part of the game plan. Third, that that the budgetary issue in Section 3, Criteria 10, we eliminate that second sentence. Fourth, that we change the metro urbanizing by removing through fee and easement acquisition. And fifth, that we adjust the waterfowl
population thing in the metro urbanizing section as well, that if we change that to populations. I think those are all the things.
One more. Section 2, item 4, substantial completion.
Oh, substantial completion. Thank you very much. So with that, can I get a motion to approve approve the call with those changes incorporated in it?
So moved.
Is there any discussion? Questions?
Does this have to be done today, David?
It does, because our schedule is to get this out to give everybody adequate time to put it together before the meeting starts. Rick?
Just to clarify, does this motion include the Jim and Scott material?
Oh, yeah.
Thank you. Dane, or Susan, does this include the incorporation of the Jim and Scott report?
Well, sure it does.
So we have a motion that's including that. Thank you for pointing that out there.
I would prefer it didn't.
Oh!
And because I think that Jim and Scott thing, I would like to hear from DNR on that. I'd like to hear from the entities if we're changing the rules of the game. I'd like to hear from the folks who would apply. I mean, I think these are two different issues, and I would if they are included, I would move to split the motion.
Okay. Representative Hansen, how do you see it changing the game? It's just describing what they've done.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Cox, it's different than what we've done before. That is a change, and I would like to hear from the agencies and the interests who apply for them. I think that's different than what we were talking about in the rest of the motion.
Okay. And if we separate this out and just put it in the accomplishment plan, would we have to go through and this?
No.
So. Heather?
We would need to have this resolved because it would be part of the proposal. And so if any changes that would be made to the budget, we would have to incorporate into the online application system, so we would need to know that.
But, Mr. Chair, it doesn't have to be part of the motion dealing with the call. And the call on page 13 talks about direct to and necessary for as the recoverable. And that's what I understand Mr. Cox's and Mr. Rawls' approach is based on. So we don't need to have it as part of the call, but we need to resolve it today.
Could we vote on the call without it and then talk about...
Yes, we can. So will you...
I'll amend my motion to pull that back off.
Okay. Great. So, any other comments or questions? Sammy, will you call the roll on the motion to approve the call with the 6, I believe, additions or modifications? Maybe a 7.
Bob Anderson?
Yes.
Jim Cox?
Yes.
Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Chair Harwell?
Yes.
Jane Kingston?
Yes.
Representative McNamara? Sue Olson?
Yes.
Ron Chera?
Yes.
Elizabeth Wilkins?
Yes.
Okay.
It's Andy. This is Andy. I was a yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. So, I'd be curious who's in the audience that could speak to Scott and Jim's proposal in terms of indirect. Anyone want to come up and give their opinion?
Mr. Chair, at some point I've got an opinion on that issue. This is Danny.
Okay, we'll make sure we hear your opinion. Thanks for coming forward.
Sure. My name is Amanda Greenberg. Okay. I'm the grants manager at DNR, and we manage the pass-through program. from what I've seen of the budget spreadsheet, this really wouldn't change too much about how we work through the process. Really, all it would change is the timeline. So we would figure out this sort of information and consult with council staff after the accomplishment plan was approved and when we were starting to implement the contract with the appropriation recipient. So this would just be taken care of before the fact rather than later on in the process.
So, Mr. Chair, to clarify, Amanda is talking about how DNR will work with the NGO to establish the NGO rate. We can hear from NGOs too, but this is something that's workable for you?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Anyone want to opine on this? Oh.
Mr. Wilson represents DNR and is familiar with DNR's calculation of the DNR rate.
Right, so Mr. Chair, members, for the record, Grant Wilson, DNR. I'll sort of bring a different look from DNR for how we would do our calculations. This basically allows us to show to you in a way that would be pretty standard for you to look at across organizations what we're doing. It wouldn't necessarily change how we're doing it, just report more clearly how that's doing. So if that helps you all see and compare, we're okay with that.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
PNC
one?
No.
TNC is an organization that's recently negotiated a rate, and I'm sure we'll be interested in being able to explain it with this forum.
Thank you. Good morning. Neil Feakin with the Nature Conservancy. I'm the Prairie Recovery Program Coordinator. And I just have had a couple minutes to review this forum as Jim and Scott have proposed. And first of all, I appreciate the council's interest and efforts at addressing this, because I think it is it's a critical issue for both agencies and non-governmental organizations. And I'll echo, I think, what Grant just said. I think if this is a way that provides more clarity to the council for how we calculate our costs, I think that that's something that we'd be interested in providing as much information as possible. But again, it won't materially impact how we calculate those costs. So I would probably maybe have some questions on exactly what some of these checkboxes are exactly, but overall, I think the way Jim described it would be a very appropriate way for us to describe how our costs are calculated.
Great. Questions? Thank you for sharing. Denny, do you have thoughts you want to share? I know you have thoughts you want to share. Would you share your thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, just real quickly, I really believe this is unnecessary. I think it follows an area that the legislative auditor has already weighed in on, and I strongly oppose that. He's explained which we need to move on to be on this issue. I do not support adding it. That's really all I have to say.
Okay. So, members, we've heard sort of from the agency standpoint, it wouldn't be an awful thing from a strategy and additional burden, perhaps. It might not be, if I'm paraphrasing, Denny. What do you want to do? Jane?
Well, my first impulse was to include it in the call so that applicants know what sort of information we're interested in. And I admit that it's not the hugest bit. It's part of the tail of the dog. It's not normally an enormous amount of money, but it is a comparator. And I think to be upfront, to have it in the call is fair. I think looking at these numbers is fair. If we don't have it in the call, I'd probably use it during the discussion and ask it as they're on the stand. So I don't see what the big deal is, especially after hearing from DNR and one of the NGOs that
they don't have a big problem with it.
Rick? Administrative question. Bill, this was on the agenda. Was the email or the sheet that was provided to the council today, was that posted?
Yes.
That was out in public?
Yes.
Secondly, the issue of direct and necessary came up in the hearing yesterday, where legislators were asking questions about administrative costs. I think that my memory is correct. Every 5 years, or throughout the 5 years, there's been questions about administrative costs. And then the audit, as Representative McNamara indicated, the auditor did provide guidance, and that is, there haven't been as many questions since we've implemented that guidance. So, and I think we could. I'm going to vote against it. Just my personal opinion here. I think we've spent a great deal of time on this, and the I'm satisfied with where we're at, fully recognizing that the council may be by the way.
Okay. So I think we have three choices. One is to add this budget spreadsheet to both the call and the accomplishment plan. One is to add it to just the accomplishment plan, and one is to not add it. I suppose we could add it to the call but not the accomplishment plan, but I didn't hear any discussion of that.
Mr. Chair, I want to make it clear that what's been presented is in the call, that we're going to do this on the basis of direct to and necessary costs. What this is a worksheet that someone fills out to show what those are. It's part of the application. What we need this information for is, if you want to do this, we have to go to the engineers, the computer programmers, and say, program this module into the application. So that's what we're looking to do. I would suggest that one of the things the council might consider is asking us to take this and work with the OLA to get it to a level that's appropriate for their work, so that we can help them as well. Because in the end, the Office of the Legislative Auditor is the one that has to look at this if we construct it and make some sense out of it relative to the expenditures that they see in them. And they'll provide us with some of their time to make sure that this works okay.
Would that be acceptable to defer this to staff and let them figure out with the legislative auditor how this would help them come back through and look at those direct and necessary expenses?
Yeah, I'll consult with Scott and Jim and anybody else that wants to be involved on the council within the realm of the open meeting law, which we can do. And we'll talk to NGOs and agencies as well. So we've got a form that works. I
so
everybody agrees with the ultimate objective.
Denny, you're the one that I can't see if you're nodding or shaking your head. Would that be something you can live with?
Mr. Chair, I'll live with Bill looking into it. Everybody knows where I'm at already, and I'm not changing, so that's fine. It's unfortunate we're spending the amount of time we are on this issue, because it does not matter what's going to happen. We are going to follow the legislative auditor's guidelines, and people are doing what they're doing, and this is a complete waste of time. I apologize, but if Bill wants to do that, that's fine, but I'm not voting to change it, put it in a call, and cause a whole bunch of more work for people that's not going to get anything accomplished. Thank you.
Okay. So I think if we want to include this, we probably need a motion to direct staff to work with the legislative auditor to figure out what the appropriate form is that will give them the best audit trail going forward. Just so that we're on the record, and I'm not looking at nods or shaking of heads. I'm trying to decide what you're telling me. So we now have four options. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chair, I'll make a motion that we staff look into it and we drop the issue right now and go ahead with the way we are.
Okay. Thank you, Denny. Ron?
Well, I am coming late to the party here on this. Going to Bill's statement, the goal here is clarity. And the auditor, again, I don't know all the details here. Sure, the auditor reviews this, but I can assure you if there's an incident where we are voting to fund a project that is exorbitant and whatever, you know who's going to make who the fault will land on. It will be this council. So that said, I mean, why would we not take any effort to make things as clear as possible, not only to us, but the public and everybody else?
Okay. So we have a motion on the table, Jim.
Just a question for Bill. So, I mean, just to put this in our accomplishment plan, how difficult is that?
I would guess it would cost us a few $1,000s in programming. My expert says more than a few $1,000s, but it's going to take some programming work. It can be done.
Aren't we changing it? Aren't we taking a lot of that stuff out this year anyway? Didn't we pick out?
We do have to go in and look at the application.
It would be more efficient to do it now than to do it separately, right?
It's as efficient to do it now, I know.
Okay, we have a motion on the table. Any other comments? Sandy, call the roll, please.
Sue Olson.
This is Denny's motion, right?
This is Denny's motion to do nothing.
Yes.
Ron Shera.
No.
Elizabeth Wilkins.
Yes.
Bob Anderson.
Yes.
Jim Cox.
No.
Representative Hansen.
Yes.
Jane Kingston.
No.
Representative McNamara.
Yeah.
No.
Chair Hartwell.
No.
5-4.
Which
five? Way? Yes.
5 yes. Okay. So we do nothing. Any other business today anyone wants to bring up? If not, we have an approved call, approved process. Thank you very much.
Back to the process we're going to use for finding an executive director. Where did that come from?
The statute, for what it's worth, says that this is done in consultation with LCC.
Okay, but all the particulars that David brought up today, who's going to be involved and those particulars, where did that come from?
That was my criteria. You can blame me or thank me, one of the two. But I've looked at this and tried to figure out, you know, the legislative auditor has to ask for our help. But
that should have been a larger discussion on it.
Well, it's really up to them to bring us candidates. That's the way it works. So if they we want them to include us.
But who's included from the council and timing and these other things?
I guess I've overstepped my bounds, but I've been trying to move it forward and make sense of this within the confines of the open meeting law, which are very restrictive in terms of what we can do. Rick?
Mr. Chair, we also have the precedent when we hired Bill. You know, that was all documented, and we went through that. I'm trying to remember back then, but I know we made a very strong effort to have the distribution of folks between the appointing authorities and between the parties. And I think that's really critical.
And for what it's worth, LCC did the original screening. I believe that Greg was on the committee. Other staffers were on the committee. And then council members made the final decision as a result of the people passed forward. That's history.
Okay.
Yeah, I have the council's privilege for one last thing.
Certainly.
You'll notice that the call for funding included content but scoring as well. We've made some decisions on scoring in the last meeting, but I think we still have more to discuss, and staff will contact individual members and talk with them about the situation and come back with a different or an improved scoring method.
Which we don't have to decide today.
Don't have to decide today.
Correct.
Don't have the homework done.
But we will perhaps talk about that in March. Okay, anything else? Thank you all very much. We are adjourned.